truth and goodness. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife. She's
my landlord, a wealthy man, living off rent like the fat of the land.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of Eviction Free 2016, a rally in March organized by Portland Tenants United. On January 15th at 4:30 p.m., tenants will gather at Portland City Hall to demand an end to no-cause evictions, landlord retaliation, and persistent discrimination against racial minorities. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
Hello, neighbors, if you try to stop an eviction, I'd be by your side. Hello, neighbors, you know you should fight for a right for the common good.
The time is 11 a.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, The Digital Divide. Welcome to The Digital Divide. In the early 1960s, scientists openly advocated for experimentation with psychedelics. William A. Richards does just that in his book Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, the first well-documented account of the effect of psychedelics on biological processes, human consciousness, and revelatory religious experiences.
Bill Richards from Psychiatry Department at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore, Maryland.
Richards argues that if used responsibly and legally, psychedelics have incredible potential to reduce human suffering and constructively contribute to the quality of life on our planet. His work is based on nearly three decades of legal research with volunteers in a medical setting aged 24 to 81. William A. Richards is a clinical psychologist with formal training in theology and comparative religion at Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. Earlier in his career, he pursued psychedelic research at the Spring Grove Hospital and Maryland Psychiatric Research Center in Baltimore. William A. Richards, welcome to The Digital Divide. Your book, Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, is a really thorough description of some of the effects of psychedelics that people have while they're under the influence of, I just think under the influence, that it, maybe it has developed a negative stigma, even though there's no reason for it to have one. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
One of the things about psychedelics is, how do we break the negative stigmas about psychedelics so that we can see them as useful tools and opportunities to expand our thinking?
Okay, how do we break the old outdated stigmas? I think it's through good education and trusting that people are intelligent enough to think. And a lot of the fears of the 1960s, you know, the idea that if you take psychedelics, you will jump out of windows and your genetic legacy will be damaged, and so on. And it's interesting to reflect as to what all was going on back in the 1960s. I think there was a lot of social change And the psychedelics kind of became a very symbol or target for a lot of different things that were going on then.
Are you saying that psychedelics represented a rejecting of old values and old systems and old ways of thinking, and that was threatening, and that was part of the reason for the pushback?
I think so. And it was a very turbulent time.
You could also say it was cathartic.
That's right. Creative, even. Hopeful, even. You know.
And then came disco.
Yeah. You know, psychedelic research became essentially totally dormant for 22 years. It was kind of a casualty of that social change. What's so wonderful is that it has begun again, and now I think we're doing it perhaps more wisely, more scientifically, with less hype and more grounded double-blind controlled studies and so on. You know, I'd certainly want to stress that psychedelics are not without their dangers and they're not for everyone, but used responsibly and wisely, they seem to have incredible promise for positive applications in the world.
What would you describe as some of the dangers of taking psychedelics?
Well, we know without doubt that what happens is much more than a simple drug effect. The experiences aren't in the substance. They're in the human mind. And these major psychedelics seem to unlock the door, if you will, to these deeper levels of consciousness. And what happens depends a lot on who you are, your capacity to trust, how safe you're feeling, the dosage and purity of the substance.
So you don't advocate just the unsupervised recreational use of psychedelics?
No. Well, I find the term recreational almost offensive.
Tell me why.
If it's recreational, maybe, you know. But psychedelics take you where you need to go. And it takes some people into very painful places initially.
Right.
You know, personal and spiritual growth isn't always fun. You know, it can take you into unresolved grief and guilt and repressed anger and confusion. And if you're not willing to go and sort out those areas, you're likely to just kind of fight for control. And then you can experience panic and you can get paranoid. And the reason you get paranoid is that you're running away from things within yourself that are asking for resolution. And all of a sudden you're feeling panic and paranoia and maybe you're ending up in a psychiatric emergency room. But it's because you're not prepared to deal with the content that you're unlocking and that your mind is presenting to you.
When you're talking about taking psychedelics, we're talking about doing it in a clinical environment that's supervised. When I first learned about psychedelic trials that were FDA approved in the United States, my jaw dropped. So are you one of the individuals who started these trials?
Well, not at the very beginning. The earliest beginnings were in the mid-50s in treatment of alcoholism in Canada, for example. And they were used a good bit in accelerating psychotherapy in Europe. And at those times, there was no controversy about psychedelics at all. Sandoz Laboratories in Switzerland simply mailed them to people who were interested in trying them out in their psychiatry practices or doing research projects with them. President Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America and so on. The research did become dormant, which is quite amazing because there had been several international conferences. There were well over 1,000 papers on psychedelic therapy that had been published in professional journals. That it was possible to get the genie back in the bottle is really quite amazing. And there's been this kind of deep freeze until Dr. Roland Griffiths and I in 1999 started research at Johns Hopkins. And this is our 16th year now, and it's going strong, and there's been no sensationalism and consistently hopeful findings.
Tell our listeners what that research and what those trials at Johns Hopkins entail.
Well, there's been a number of studies. The first one was a double-blind controlled study just to demonstrate that it is indeed psilocybin that causes these deep, profound, transcendental or spiritual experiences and not simply suggestion. We did a study with Ritalin and psilocybin, and everything was held constant except the contents of the pill that was given on a particular day. And no one but the pharmacist knew what was in that pill. The preparation, the music, the physical setting was all the same. And clearly we demonstrated scientifically that those who received psilocybin had these profound experiences, and those who received Ritalin as a whole did not.
What type of people qualify for these studies? Like, who gets in a study like that? Because I know everybody in our audience is raising their hand right now.
Well, it depends on the study. There's a lot of different studies. You know, after that, we did a dose response study where people got different doses to see what the response would be. Then we've done research using psilocybin to help people stop nicotine smoking. And so to qualify for that one, you have to have tried to stop and failed many times, and finally you can qualify for our research project. We have done work that's just about to be published using psilocybin to help people with serious physical illnesses such as terminal cancer to help treat their depression and anxiety. Open up their interpersonal communication, helps many of them lose a fear of death when they have these very profound experiences. But to qualify for that, unfortunately, of course, you have to have a diagnosis of cancer, and you have to have a significant degree of anxiety. Every study has its own selection criteria.
Right.
We have a project right now for full-time religious professionals to see if some profound religious experiences might increase the effectiveness of their ministry.
And are people signing up for that?
Yes, yeah, but you have to be a full-time clergy person in charge of a church or synagogue or mosque or sangha in order to qualify and so on.
So are you recruiting? How do people get enrolled in that?
Well, they usually find our website, which is religiousleaderstudy.org, and that tells exactly what the selection criteria are and how to go about expressing interest. And we even have travel funds to help people who need it and so on.
Now, in the 60s, you signed yourself up as a research subject.
That's right.
Tell us about that.
Well, actually, it was the early 60s. Well, yes, it was the 60s, 1963.
That's right.
That's right, a long time ago. But when I signed up, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't know the word psychedelic, and I certainly couldn't spell psilocybin. I had just heard that there was this drug at the clinic in Göttingen, Germany, that was allowing some people to gain new insight into their early childhood, and I thought that sounded interesting, so I applied and got accepted and was led to a little basement room and given some psilocybin and left alone. And by some miracle, I had a very positive experience that has influenced the rest of my life.
It changed your life. That one experience opened up doorways that made you say, what the heck was that? And I want to go there again and look around some more.
What did you give me? How do you spell that? Yeah.
And what was that experience that was so, you know, life-changing and cathartic for you?
Well, I describe it in the introduction to my book, yep. Sacred Knowledge. But it was basically a unitive mystical type of consciousness that I did not even know was possible and certainly didn't expect on that day. So I was one very odd 23-year-old graduate student.
Those mystical experiences, let's kind of dive in there. Even though each person's experience is, unique to them, there are commonalities, there are threads that run through so many people's experiences. The feelings of unity, transcendence, everything's exactly as it should be, everything is connected. These thoughts or experiences that people have are so consistent. And you say in your book that even though someone may experience this, they may not experience it every time they take the psychedelics. They may only have that experience once, or they may skip a few times and have it again. Talk to us a little bit about that, those experiences that people have.
Sure, I'd be happy to. First, I guess I'd like to back up and just stress for your listeners who aren't familiar with this area of research that there's no such thing as kind of the psychedelic experience any more than there's one altered state or one meditative state. There's a whole range of incredibly different states of consciousness within the human mind, from just mild perceptual changes to reliving things from childhood to visionary states of landscapes and precious stones and gods and goddesses, to what we call this mystical consciousness, which is this profound unitive state that just feels intrinsically sacred and is so beyond language that some people don't even try to put it into words. They'd rather compose music or write a poem than write a research report.
We don't actually have words to adequately describe some of the experiences.
That's right. There's a line in the Tao Te Ching, the Chinese scriptures, that I love to quote. It just says, "Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know," you know? And there's a certain wisdom in that. But since we're doing research, of course, we want to try to put it into language as much as we can. And the way we've done it is with six categories, that when someone has one of these mystical experiences, or when one of those mystical experiences has somebody, and they write a report, you can always find six categories, which are unity, transcendence of time and space, intuitive knowledge, a sense of sacredness, deeply felt positive mood such as joy, peace, and love, and claims of ineffability and what we say paradoxicality. It's very hard to put into words. So people say, "I died, but I was never more alive," or "the ultimate one was only one ultimate reality, but it contained everything that is." And it sounds like people are contradicting each other, but it's really what philosophers would acknowledge as just the paradoxical nature of these profound states of human consciousness.
So when people are having a psychedelic experience or an experience while under the influence of psychedelics, and that's real for them. However, how do we know that that's real or not just their imaginations kind of running wild or not just chemically induced sensations or maybe hallucinations or thoughts that are just chemically induced but aren't actually real? Whereas, you know, we're kind of talking under the presumption that people have mystical experience, that is a real experience. And presumably, that world, that universe, that unity that they're perceiving is real and exists beyond our, you know, three-dimensional touchy-feely world. So how do we know that that's real and not just a chemically induced or imagination or emotional?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And that's the type of question that can be debated late into the night. It's similar to the question, how do you know that you love your spouse or your children? You know, what do you choose to trust? And there are experiences, especially these transcendental mystical experiences, that when they occur, they just intuitively feel profoundly real. People say that it felt more real than talking to you right now. And there's just something very fundamental about it that's very convincing. And you can always say, well, maybe it's a big delusion, you know?
Right.
But throughout history, throughout the origins of religious literature, the whole history of mysticism, you know, people have reported these experiences with awe and respect and a sense that there's something incredibly precious about them. Cancer patients who have this experience and lose their fear of death often talk about, gee, I felt like I went back to where I was before I was born, or I went to a place outside of time. Or if someone knows the language of Zen Buddhism, they might say, I entered into the very center of the present moment and discovered the eternal has always been there. You know? So there are different ways to try to put it into language. But these deep experiences, whether they occur with psychedelics or spontaneously or in meditation or natural childbirth or creative performance or whatever, they occur in lots of different ways. But when they happen, they have kind of a lasting legacy, and they feel very real and convincing to those who have them. Is it just chemical? Well, what's chemical? Maybe there's a chemical substrate to everything that goes on, including the thoughts we're having right now. Chemistry becomes another language of talking about reality, or physics may become another language of talking about reality. And it all gets pretty mysterious when you get down to the quantum theory and the mysteries of matter and so on. Physics gets very close to the spiritual, if not another language to talk about it at times.
Well, that's why we add the word meta onto the word physics, to kind of describe more than what we can pick up in the physical, tangible world.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that traditional religion, modern religion, is threatened by the prospect that people would identify with a larger, you know, being that some people might call God or the universe or whatever they might call it?
Well, speaking religious language, I would say God does not need us to defend him or her. The divine or sacred dimension of consciousness is quite capable of defending itself. And I don't think there's anything to be feared. I think it's a huge frontier in theology and religious studies. In fact, in my book, there's a chapter on implications for religion. You know, if you go back in time, that time when the Pope said the earth was flat, and, you know, Bruno was burned at the stake for saying that wasn't the case, you know?
Right.
But theology has matured, and the vision of the universe now is infinitely richer and every bit as awesome, if not more so, than when they thought there were crystalline spheres up in the sky. I don't think religion has anything to fear. If anything, it's a huge frontier that might also enhance appreciation for different religious traditions of the world, almost like learning different languages. It doesn't devalue your own history, but it may enable you to see how God is so much bigger than we ever thought, if you want to use the word God. Some people would want to use a different word because those three letters have negative connotations. You know, they think of trying to sit still in a boring sermon, and they don't want any more of that kind of religion, you know?
Right.
But there's a much more sophisticated approach to a religion that's much more in harmony with the frontiers of science.
Because people don't necessarily have the same experience every time when they take, let's say, psilocybin or LSD, they don't always have that quote-unquote God experience.
That's right.
And that seems to be, some people might call, if you have it, some people might say, well, that's grace. That's a good example of grace. You don't always have it. Why do people have it sometimes and not others?
Well, you have to ask God. When they occur, a person is being completely open, is trusting unconditionally, is willing to learn whatever needs to be learned, even if it involves some suffering. And then these experiences sometimes come. And when they come, it's always a sacred moment. It's always a gift. It's like awakening to a deeper reality that feels intrinsically eternal and sacred. It may be triggered by a drug, but it can also be triggered in other ways.
Right.
Even when we're meditating, we are affecting our inner biochemistry, the balance of gases in our blood, by breath control, for example. Sometimes these experiences happen in natural childbirth, and who knows what physiological changes are going on then, you know?
What it really sounds like is that the potential to have that, I'm going to call it a meta experience, that transcendent experience.
That's a good term.
That is in you all the time, and that's psychedelics or dance or prayer or meditation or art, whatever it is, any of those have the potential to unlock the key that's already in you that can foster that experience.
That's right. You know, the Buddha is the man who woke up.
Right.
And perhaps there's a Buddha within us all. You know, a point I want to be sure to get into our program here, too, though, yes, is that it's not only that these mystical experiences are, you know, awesomely inspiring and beautiful and wonderful and all that, which is not to be underestimated. But what makes us so interested in them in psychiatry is that they also seem to have what William James called fruits for life, is that there are changes in attitude and behavior that often come in their wake. And, you know, William James took this pragmatic stance that by their fruits ye shall know them, you know? And regardless of whether the state is genuine or illusory or epiphenomenon of some physiological process or however you want to understand it, if you just look at, well, what does it do to you? And our findings are that, you know, highly functioning people to begin with claim to feel more integrated, more compassionate, more tolerant of people who see the world differently than they used to. They claim less anxiety, less depression, more humor, more playfulness. All the things that Abraham Maslow, one of my wonderful mentors way back in graduate school, described as characteristics of self-actualizing or highly functioning people. And Maslow found that many of these highly functioning people like Albert Einstein and Eleanor Roosevelt had these experiences spontaneously, as he himself did. Maslow never took psychedelics. He'd just lie down in his backyard and have mystical experiences. And some people have kind of an innate biochemistry that seems to make these experiences accessible. And others of us generally need some assistance, either through meditative practices or someday when these drugs become legal in appropriate centers with the use of psychedelics.
I'm Rabia Yeaman with The Digital Divide, and today I'm speaking with William A. Richards. His book, Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, is the first well-documented, sophisticated account of the effect of psychedelics on biological processes, human consciousness, and revelatory religious experiences. In your experiences with psychedelics, talking about consciousness, how do you define consciousness? How would you define it?
Well, that's one of these huge, huge questions. I think of consciousness as kind of the ultimate nature of energy, of the mystery of what we are. And with all due respect to the incredible frontiers in neuroscience, where we're beginning to link certain states of consciousness with certain activity in certain areas of the brain and so on, we hardly know what we are yet. There's a huge mystery of what is consciousness, what is the human psyche, what are we, you know?
We have mystics among us, like, let's take Ram Dass or Richard Alpert, who I don't know if you had any contact with during your...
Yes, I knew Richard before he became Ram Dass.
Okay.
That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
One of the questions I just wanted to kind of pose to you that comes from mystical experience or experience under psychedelics, and that is a kind of a common experience that people share, maybe not every time. But one of the commonalities that you talked about is time, the perception of time. And even during our conversation today, you've said, you know, outside of time, yes, going outside. So time definitely is a human construct. I think if you doesn't take much argument to say, well, we invented time and that keeps everything orderly.
Right. Time and space and substance.
Right. But yeah, but if everything...
That's the way we organize our world.
That's right. That's right. And sometimes when you might be under the influence of psychedelics, then people might have a common experience of there either not being any time or time just not being relevant. So so my question is, if everything that is happening at any one time is exactly what is supposed to be happening... So in other words, everything is exactly in its place in time. Why study? Why meditate? Why practice whatever you practice? Because everything that's happening is exactly as it should be in that perception.
That's a deep philosophical question. It's the way I think of it is that the life of the ego, our everyday personalities, that part of us that goes with our common name, that goes to work and comes home and cooks dinner, you know?
Right, chops wood, carries water, right.
That's right. That part of us has its own reason for being, and it's part of the magnificence of the universe. And I think egos are to be treated well and respected and cared for.
Well, they help us get to work in the morning.
Right. I think to kill off the ego, to have a mystical experience, will just create depression. That you've got to value the ego. But having said that, there are other states of consciousness to which we have access that go beyond our individual personalities, that where you have a sense of the family of man, our universal heritage, the realm of the archetypes, these profound spiritual states that seem tied in with the origins of religious systems and revelation. And they're incredibly beautiful and incredibly awesome. And I think if there is such a thing as enlightenment, it's being aware of both of those realms. You know, in Buddhism, what does the enlightened man do? He chops wood and carries water, you know?
He does exactly what he's doing before he was enlightened.
That's right. He does it maybe with more joy and more inner peace, but he still functions in the world.
Right.
And if we became more enlightened as a culture, I think we might be a more creative, peaceful, compassionate lot. But I think we'd still accomplish a lot, and the world would still be a very wonderful place in which to live. We might be more intelligent in the way we solve some of our international conflicts, you know?
Well, one would hope. None of them make any sense to me anyway. I can't figure out what everybody's fighting about.
That's right.
In your book, you write, space is similarly claimed to be transcended in mystical states. The heavenly realms are not experienced as located in a particular place, either in our universe or in another galaxy, like some vacation spot where one could send a spaceship if we knew the vectors to program the address to. Tell us more about that.
Well, that again is just the consistent claims of mystics throughout religious literature and people who have these transcendental experiences today with or without psychedelics. And consistently they say that consciousness can somehow manifest itself beyond time and space. And physicists might call it the energy dance or something like that.
Is that the same as saying unification?
I think that would fit.
So is it reasonable to speculate at least that all of us as individuals and everything that is alive in the world, and maybe things that aren't alive because they're still made up of things that are kind of buzzing around, that the whole of all of our perceptually separate thoughts, actions, our thought words and deeds make up the universal consciousness? Or is it bigger than that?
Probably it's even bigger than that, yes. Where when people claim to be outside of time in their awareness, they often claim, you know, access to the past or the future, or there, some people believe in prior lifetimes, and it's just an incredible frontier that we hardly know where to begin our studies.
Do you have a position on reincarnation?
No, but I am very open to it. A lot of people in our world take it for granted, as much as we tend to take it for granted that we only have one life. We'll find out when we get there, I guess.
We'll either find out or we won't. What do you want people to take away from your book? How can they use it?
Well, I would hope my book will help to promote new research with psychedelics. I hope it will promote more tolerance and appreciation for the incredible frontier that we have arrived at. I hope it will dispel some of the old wives' tales from the 1960s and the unnecessary and irrational fears that people have about psychedelics. I hope those who choose to use them before they become legal, and I think the day will come when they will be legal, but I hope those who choose to take those risks will do it more wisely. I think there is an art to using them, much more involved than simply swallowing a pill or a capsule. And if someone is determined to use them, it would behoove them to do some good research about how to use them wisely so that they may be beneficial and not detrimental in their effects.
I know that there are a lot of what some people call designer drugs, and also there are substances that are, you know, bought, sold, and distributed on the street that people call LSD, and then they have the, like, an incorrect perception that they've taken this substance and that the experience that they had, you know, was not on that substance. It was, and they don't even know what they're ingesting. And I think that people have become very, especially younger people, very casual about that. And we hear occasionally of people dying at raves or different festivals from taking substances that they just don't know what they're doing, or they're taking two or three and they're mixing them together and they don't even know what they're on. And I think that has the potential to, you know, push back the positive movement that your research has done.
That's right. There are incredible risks when you don't know what you're taking and you don't know the purity, you don't know the dosage, you don't even know if it really is what it's claimed to be.
Right.
And that's one of the dangers of these drugs being illegal, where if you could go to a retreat center and be medically screened and well prepared and learn how to respond constructively to the opportunity of consciousness opening up within, and have support and wise choice of music and interpersonal grounding and all this good stuff, then it's a very different scene. And I hope to live long enough to see that become reality.
I would like to see that become reality too. Do you do research with LSD?
We haven't to this point. We've stuck with psilocybin primarily for a number of reasons. One is LSD is simply so controversial that people go crazy when they hear those three letters.
They'll be listening to this show, I can promise you that.
But also psilocybin has a long natural history, a good safety record. It's been used and is still being used by Indians in their religious ceremonies. It's really a very promising substance for practical applications in medicine, for example.
When you do research with psilocybin, are you using synthesized or natural forms?
We're using synthesized psilocybin.
And how does that work?
Well, exactly the same as the natural form, really. It's the psilocybin molecule. Ours has come from a chemistry laboratory at Purdue University. But there's no question that it's a very sacred substance when it's used wisely. And it's very effective. And thus we're able to know the purity and the exact dosage of the substance that we're administering. Where if you're using mushrooms, there's 180 different species of psilocybin-containing mushrooms. And they may all vary in potency depending on how they were grown and how they've been handled and what other substances might be in the mushrooms besides psilocybin. So it's much more scientifically clean to work with the synthetic substance.
I think if there was more knowledge about the type of work that you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and the research that's going on, that a lot of people would be more conscientious and not as willing to just, you know, basically eat anything. It's like they're taking a calculated risk
mm-hmm.
in terms of, you know, what they're actually putting in their body and the long-term effects that it might have on them.
That's right.
The types of drugs that people say they're taking all the time. Sometimes I wonder, have I turned into my grandma, or am I, is that concern, you know, warranted? And it feels legitimate. It feels like, mm-hmm. yeah, some of these things are just chemicals and you don't have any idea what they are. And neither do I.
That's right. Actually, in my book, I use the metaphors of downhill skiing. And I remember I write about the first time I went skiing without any instruction whatsoever, and what a total fool I made of myself, and how I endangered myself and other people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But with some instruction, and you learn how to control your speed and slow down and determine safe directions and not hit trees and so on, skiing can be quite wonderful for many people. There's some who may never choose to go skiing, and that's all right, you know?
Raising my hand right now.
Exploring consciousness. And it's not only with psychedelics, it's also with meditative techniques.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know what you're doing, and you have to go about it with some seriousness and wisdom, and read what's out there to help you learn from other people's mistakes, you know?
How does ayahuasca fit into all of this?
You know, ayahuasca is the sacred substance used in Brazilian religions.
Mm-hmm.
Is very similar to psilocybin molecularly. The active ingredient is DMT, dimethyltryptamine. And actually, one of the fascinating thoughts theoretically is that our bodies seem to naturally produce DMT. Who knows where? Some people think it may be in lung tissue or whatever. But DMT has been found naturally synthesized in the human body. And one theory of spontaneous transcendental experiences is that the dose of that substance, or who knows what other chemicals that may inhibit it or whatever it is, but there's a psychopharmacological basis for these experiences, even when they occur spontaneously, that may be very similar to what happens when someone takes mushrooms or ayahuasca or peyote, or the so-called major psychedelic substances. The insight from mystical states is always that consciousness appears to be indestructible, that the eternal world is simply there, somehow beyond time and space and matter. And we barely know how to begin to put that into language and rational constructs. I think of the Nataraja, the dancing Shiva in Hinduism, you know, the god that constantly dances as worlds come into being and go out of being, sort of like a child who makes a tower of blocks and knocks it over gleefully and builds another tower, you know? And that concept in religion of civilizations coming and going is pretty awesome. And to see it all as part of a dance, I'm rather committed to our planet and our dance right now.
Yes.
And I would like to see us thrive and be more ecologically sensitive and be more at peace with one another and move towards some sort of utopia or golden age, not in a naive way, but in a very realistic way. And I'm kind of an optimist.
What's your next project?
Well, I'm plenty busy right now working on this project with professional religious leaders.
Tell us about that.
Well, that's to see if to what extent a couple well-designed, well-prepared for psilocybin sessions might help clergy feel more effective in their ministries.
How many people participating in that right now?
Well, it's just a small pilot study of 24 people right now. But there is also promise for what my friend Bob Jesse at the Council on Spiritual Practices calls the betterment of well people. And the psychedelics may have significant value for healthy people who would like to be more creative, more compassionate, more effective in the way they live.
Sign me up. Where do I sign up?
Well, keep tuned.
I will keep tuned. How many different faiths are represented in the 24-person study right now?
Well, the psychedelic research since its rebirth about a decade ago, a decade and a half now, actually is expanding. It's going on at not only Hopkins, but New York University, the University of Wisconsin, University of Alabama in Birmingham. Work was going on at UCLA in Los Angeles, in Zurich, and in Spain, in Barcelona. So it's a very hopeful time for those of us who are dedicated to responsible legal studies here.
I think it's a miracle. And I know that most people, you know, that I talk to have no idea that there are actual FDA-approved studies going on in multiple locations that involve psychedelics. And I know from MAPS that just in 2015, they finally got approval for research for marijuana for the treatment of PTSD, which is kind of amusing. But a lot of people don't know that these studies are going on, and that really speaks volumes that there's evidence, there's scientific consideration that these substances can be helpful in possibly a variety of uses.
Yes. Yeah, I think in medicine, in education, and in religion. Three of the chapters of my book address that specifically.
William Richards, author of the book Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences. Where can people learn more about your work?
Well, they certainly can obtain my book, and it's out there, both in digital form and hardback at this point. If people are interested in the Hopkins study, a good source is csp.org/psilocybin, the Council on Spiritual Practice site that has a pretty good compilation of the professional articles we've published and the commentaries on them. Arrowwood.org always has a lot of good information about the frontiers of psychedelic research.
And of course, there's MAPS.org.
And MAPS.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that these studies provide a basis for justifying, you know, the ongoing use and study and research of not only the chemicals themselves, but consciousness and religion, and what that means in relationship to our physical world.
Yes, yeah.
Well, I can't thank you enough for your time this afternoon.
Well, thank you for inviting me to be on the program. And all good wishes to everyone who would venture into a deeper understanding of human consciousness.
And we've been listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Rabia Yeaman. That was William A. Richards. talking about his book, and Sacred Knowledge, Psychedelics and Religious Experiences, and his ongoing clinical trials with psilocybin at Johns Hopkins University. Be sure and tune in the second Friday of every month, starting at 11 a.m. for more interesting interviews, stories, and news about technology, science, metaphysics, the works. Coming up next is Moving On with Dawn Jacobson. So keep your radio turned on. Radio, keep you turned on. KBOO Portland.
I always say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
Hi, I'm Shahid Hamid. With each passing year, the words of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. become more and more necessary to remember. With this in mind, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO Foundation members would like to invite you, your family, and friends to their 31st anniversary and tribute to the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 18th, broadcast live from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Highland Christian Center in Portland. As in years past, there will be a variety of local and regional choirs, performers, and entertainers, all paying homage to the work and legacy of Dr. King and our efforts to keep his dream alive. So remember, Monday, January the 18th, at the Highland Christian Center, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and of course, right here on KBOO FM radio.
The greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
And I saw records made. Music literally written in wax.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd Real Music Film Festival, running through February 8th. Friday, February 5th, will show American Epic. The film pieces together the extraordinary 1920s story of record companies leaving the big city to tour America's backroads and capture for the first time the raw musical expressions of rural cultures. These field recordings, initially aimed for the rural markets from which they came, democratized music and gave voice to the most marginalized demographics in the nation. That's February 5th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center in the Witzel Auditorium at 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information on the films and more at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now the KBOO News at Noon for today, Friday, January 8th, 2016. I'm Don Merrill. In local news, the Oregonian is reporting that the city wants to appeal a federal judge's ban on keeping certain people out of city council meetings. Judge Michael Simons, in a recent ruling, prohibited the city from excluding disruptive people from meetings. Mayor Charlie Hales doesn't agree with the judge's ruling and says the city can't hold meetings when people are being disruptive. Mayor Hales says the city will appeal, and that appeal is going to be going to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. The Oregonian is reporting that violence broke out at the Malheur Federal Wildlife Reserve in Malheur County on Wednesday night. Lewis Arthur, a leader of a citizens group called Veterans on Patrol, said one of his three-person crew was hospitalized after being punched in the face by one of the Arizona occupiers on site with Annan Bundy, son of statist Cliven Bundy. Arthur said his intentions was to remove women, children, and Ryan Payne, one of the most prominent occupiers, from the compound. Others inside tell